Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, the business of talking about artists. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
This is another of our special episodes looking back at the biggest news stories we covered in CMU during our first 2 decades in existence. Although this one is a little bit different, because while we've focused on big music business developments in the other episodes in this series, I wanted to turn to the other side of CMU, the dark side of CMU, you might say. I mean, you probably wouldn't, but I wanted to build a bit of tension into the proceedings.
Well, I'm sure we're all feeling very tense as a result of you building up that tension.
You should be.
So the other side of CMU, the dark side of CMU. So what is it that we're here to talk about in this special edition?
Well, the CMU Daily
yeah.
is a music industry news service.
It is.
Aimed at people who work in the music industry. I guess you could say it's a trade paper of sorts. But we cover a lot of artist news.
We do.
That is not normal.
It's true.
So for this episode of our 20th anniversary series, I wanted to do things differently. Because we haven't talked that much about CMU in this series about CMU.
No, we haven't. Because we're keen to champion the business of music. It shouldn't be about us. Apart from this issue where it's all about us. No, not really.
Well, not all about us.
No.
But partly. Well, I mean, I thought as I've got one of the founders of CMU here.
Well done.
That being you.
Top booking.
And I'm just some Johnny-come-lately who's only been here for a decade. I thought I'd use this time to get to the bottom of why CMU's just so bloody weird. We can talk about why CMU covers artist news, and then we can talk about some of the biggest artist stories from the last 2 decades.
Yeah, it is true that although CMU, in essence, is trade publication for the music industry, one of many trade publications for music. Why are so many people writing about the music business? It's not that interesting. But I guess when we set CMU up in the late 1990s, we had various aims that we felt would make CMU different to everybody else who was writing about the music industry at that time, some of whom are still going now, some of whom have long since disappeared and new people have taken their place. But I guess, yeah, focusing on artist news as much as business news was one of the things that we felt made us a bit different. And I think there were various reasons for that. I think it was because we quite fancied writing about artists as much as the business side. I think it was because we had quite a big reviewing operation in the early days of CMU. We used to review singles and albums and things that were happening and being released on sort of the more creative artistic side of the industry until you came along and removed that.
Yeah, shut that down.
You cancelled all the reviewing side. But we did quite a lot of reviewing in the early days, and so we were already very much in sort of writing as much about the music as the business of music. But also I think we felt that the other big aim of CMU was to unite the wider music community, because in the 1990s, most trade media was in print with maybe a little bit of online on the side. A lot of it was subscription-based, a lot of it was quite expensive, and a lot of it was based at the more the corporate end of the music business. And very much we wanted to be the opposite of that. So we were trying to reach out to everybody working at the major record companies and the major music publishers and the big live companies and the radio industry and the TV industry. We were aiming to reach the mainstream music business, but we also wanted to make sure that we reached the grassroots music industry, which traditionally the trade press didn't make any effort to reach, and generally they didn't have much of a readership in that part of the music community. So what do we mean by that? We meant people who were running small venues and clubs, and maybe people who are active on the student circuit, doing like student union nights, student radio, student press, fanzine editors, and the earliest of the bloggers. So the people who are writing about music for fun, the grassroots gig promoters, the people who like run labels out of their kitchen, manage bands on the side, and indeed people who actually were making music, whether they were record producers or writers or artists. That sort of grassroots community that had not been traditionally serviced by the music business press.
Oh, it was as a fanzine editor I first encountered CMU.
Well, exactly. So there you go.
The system worked.
We tick a box there. And we felt that we were trying to reach the wider music community. And the wider music community were as interested in music and the artists making that music and the releases and the tours and the albums and the signings and all of the crazy stuff that artists were doing. They were as interested in all of that as they were in the business side. And so we thought we should be 50-50. We should be covering the industry stuff and the artist stuff. And then I think over the years, we have done that. And I suppose we sometimes merge the two. So there's stuff that's happening that maybe the traditional music press, the NMEs and Melody Makers, and more recently the Quietuses and the Noises and the Vices of this world will be covering, but there's a little bit of an industry spin that we can put on it. So for example, I think we have become quite well known for our coverage of any litigation or criminal action involving music people.
Yes.
We cover anything happening in what we call the pop courts, certainly in the UK and the US, and occasionally beyond that as well. And so a lot of those stories are often being covered in the mainstream music press, and we cover them too, but we can give a little bit of a legal business background to it. But then also we can cover business stories, but covering any sort of genuine artist, grassroots songwriter element to them that maybe our competitors in the more traditional trade press are not doing. So that is kind of how we ended up coming up with the format, which was, okay, we're going to make sure that our readership is anybody in any way connected to the making of music, and we're going to cover artist news as much as we cover industry news.
Has it changed over time? Was it a 50-50 split always, or was it, did you start out doing more artist and a bit of business? And I mean, it's definitely more business now, but has that changed over time?
You're probably right that initially we had more artist news than business news, and then slowly but surely that started to tip. I think by the time we launched the CMU Daily, because originally obviously CMU was a monthly magazine, by the time we launched the Daily Bulletin in 2002, it probably then was around about 50-50. And it might have been that we were doing more artist news in total, but the artist stories tended to be quite short and sweet, whereas the business stories tended to go in more in depth. And indeed, we've made that even more so in more recent years by adding the one-liners.
Yeah.
Because quite often it was, we were writing 200 words about somebody bringing out a record when really all we needed to say was someone was bringing out a record. So probably in terms of word count, we definitely write a lot more about the business side now than we used to. But actually, in things that we are reporting on, I think probably we are announcing more artist stuff than we are business stuff, because there's more artist stuff going on than business stuff. But yeah, the balance probably has slightly changed. It was because we do both artist news and business news, and because we're trying to reach both the mainstream music industry and the grassroots music industry, that we ultimately went with Complete Music Update as our name. Of course, that wasn't originally our name.
No.
You were involved in that. There was a day when me and Andy sat down with the dictionary. I'm not quite sure how we had that much time. I don't remember us ever having that much spare time.
No.
We sat down with the dictionary and went through the entire C section to try and decide which C word we thought would be good for the C of CMU, because originally it stood for College Music Update, because I mentioned our big aim originally was to reach both the mainstream and the grassroots music industry. Mainstream industry, easy. We know where all they live. Grassroots industry, much harder to reach. And actually, in 1998, it was even harder to reach because there weren't forums and lists online where you could reach those people. And so initially, we used the college network. We used student radio, student unions, student newspapers, student music clubs to try and reach out to the grassroots. That was originally a big part of what we did. So the C stood for college, but we very quickly became much bigger than that. So I guess it was probably about, not quite 10 years ago, 8 years ago, where it's like, well, what other C word could we use? And complete, I mean, even though in some ways that's a bit of an over-bragging statement, of course we're not complete.
No.
We're not covering everything by any means, but it's to try and show that we are covering both artist news and business news, and we're trying to reach both the mainstream business and the grassroots business, and that is still very much part of what we do today.
A lot of CMU's more sarcastic side gets funneled into a lot of the artist news.
I suppose that's the other thing that...
I mean, that is the other thing that is different from other trade, that we insult the people we're writing about, including, I mean, that's insult our readership quite a lot of the time.
That is one thing that makes CMU quite unique. And certainly, it was kind of there in the early days, but really started to grow once the Daily Bulletin was launched. And you're right. I mean, obviously, both of us, I know, it amuses us greatly. Most trade media, whatever sector, not just the music industry, the vast majority of trade publications, tends to pander to the audience that it's writing to, which, I mean, makes commercial sense.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Why wouldn't you? And you, basically, you tell the industry you're writing about, whether that's, I don't know, the banking industry or the technology industry or the music industry, you tell the people you're writing about how brilliant they are. And yes, occasionally you might criticise decisions that individuals or companies or organisations have made. Yes, you might sometimes write about the bad news when companies do silly things or when things go wrong, or when people go bankrupt or when people fall out. Yes, you may cover the negative as well as the positive. But generally, the overall tone is you're all brilliant.
Yeah.
Whereas CMU's overall tone is you're all idiots. We don't genuinely believe you're all idiots, just some of you. But That is quite unusual for trade press. There is a publication in the IT business called The Register that is very similar.
Yeah.
I've always thought their strapline, we've never managed to come up with a strapline, because theirs is biting the hand that feeds it slash IT. Very clever strapline. We've never managed to come up with anything like that at CMU. But you're right. Obviously, we have our occasionally sarcastic tone in the daily, which sometimes we apply to business stories because it amuses us to write about very serious copyright reform stories and then go all sarcastic. And someone was reminding me the other day, we haven't done this so much recently, how often when we got press releases about business stuff with long quotes and quotes that employed like jargon or buzzed words, that we'd often run half the quote and then put blah, blah, blah or something at the end. And we kind of stopped doing that for some reason. But someone brought that up recently.
Oh, maybe we should start doing that again.
But you're right. I suppose sometimes when you're writing business stories, the sarcasm would feel forced or out of place. Although we do quite often do it with those stories where it's a straight announcement and we know every single one of our competitors is reporting on the same announcement because we all got sent the same press release. We've all cut and pasted the same quote into our content management system. And that's, I suppose, on the business side where we tend to get sarcastic, kind of sending ourselves up for taking a quote out of a press release and turning it into a story like every other music business publication. But yes, on the artist side, there is often room for sarcasm because artists are prone to... Well, most artists just make really good music and we like writing about that.
Yeah.
And you in particular write a lot about the artists who are making really, really good music. And fortunately, in the 20 years we've been going, every single year, artists and songwriters continue to make really, really good music. So that's helpful.
It's been helpful, yeah.
But some artists say ridiculous things.
Yes, they do. Now, I know the answer to this, but it's the question that people always ask me. Is does that sarcastic tone ever get you into trouble?
Does it ever get us into trouble?
And does it get you into more trouble on the artist side or the business side?
Interesting question. Depends what you mean by trouble, I guess.
Well, we've never gone to prison.
We've never gone to prison.
Yet.
We've never gone to court. That's not to say we've not had threats of going to court, but we've never actually gone to court. And I think that there are, I don't think, I know. I know there are people in the music industry, whether they are artists or on the business side, who think that our tone is silly and a bit childish and they don't like it.
Fair enough.
And that's what all our competitors are there for.
Yep.
There's lots of other places you can go and get your music business news. But I would say the vast majority of our readers, it's the thing they really like.
Yes.
Is the sarcasm. And we often talk about how we're not as sarcastic now as we used to be.
No, I mean, if you go back to some of, like, maybe 10 years ago, there's stuff, like, I go back and read stuff now and think, I can't believe we said that.
And I suppose it was that sarcasm was quite harsh back in the day.
Yeah.
Now we mock people, but I don't think we are as harsh. And sometimes I think that we should go back to being harsh. I don't know. It's kind of the zeitgeist, isn't it? That you're kind of slightly more aware that maybe the artist you're being harsh about might ultimately see this, and then how will they feel? And I don't think 10 years ago you thought about that.
No.
I don't know whether that's just because we're older now or whether the world's moved on.
I'm certainly older.
I'm older too.
Yeah.
So we both have that in common.
I also think the world's... But social media's changing, hasn't it? When people can directly tweet you and go, that's not very nice. Oh no, it wasn't, was it?
Well, also, I think maybe as social media's become a bigger thing, you feel more sorry for artists because they're at the receiving end of a constant flood of outrageous, unnecessary things which are being pushed right into their faces. And therefore, you feel more sorry for people that maybe 10 years ago you would have been mocking yourself in writing. The other thing I always think of the artists, I mean, we're going to focus in on three of the big artist stories that we have covered over the last 20 years because those were of the 20 big stories, the ones we identified back at the start of all of this last May, one of which is quite sarcasm heavy, the other two not at all. Although, I suppose if we're being honest, one of them we were quite sarcastic at times. But, as always interests me that throughout CMU's history, I think there have been certain artists that for whatever reason we latch onto. And I think it's because they're the artists who just seem to get, for a period of time, so much more reportage about their antics than their music. So, for example, there was the Doherty year, where pretty much every day we wrote about Pete Doherty. And it was when he was hanging out with Kate Moss. Did he get married? I can't remember. But they became tabloid fodder, didn't they?
Yes.
The Libertines went from being this cool band to being this collapsing band to being this guy dating a supermodel on the front page of The Sun. And we documented all of Pete Doherty's antics on a pretty much daily basis. There was a year when that's all we seemed to write about. And there have been other points in CMU's history where there were certain artists who, for whatever reason, we seem to be writing about it all the time.
So as you mentioned, we're going to look at three of the biggest artist news stories that we've covered during CMU's first two decades. You mentioned Pete Doherty and also artists' private lives overtaking somewhat their actual music careers. Amy Winehouse was someone, certainly around the time I joined CMU, we were covering a lot in a similar way to Pete Doherty, like on a daily basis.
She kind of took over, didn't she, from Doherty. He had that period where he was on the front pages of the tabloids every day for about 18 months, and then he went off to rehab and all of that, and then he kind of disappeared for a while and then came back actually making music again.
Yeah.
And almost Amy Winehouse took over. And of course, you know, they sometimes hung out with each other, occasionally collaborated with each other. So there was even a little bit of crossover between those two stories. But there was a period, yeah, where most of our reporting on Amy Winehouse was not about the music she was making. It was about the music that she was often failing to perform. But it hadn't always been that way.
No.
We did start talking about Amy Winehouse way before any of that, because actually, we really rated her music.
Yeah.
And actually, this was the era when we used to do artist interviews. Don't do that anymore. But we used to run interviews with artists who were making music that we really liked. We always kind of skewed towards artists who were either new or they had something new out that we particularly rated. And so we did interview Amy Winehouse twice, actually. I did one of those interviews. But the first interview was around about her first album coming out, which was called Frank.
It was.
And that was some time before all of the tabloid nonsense that followed. That was very much about, you're a new artist, we're very excited about what you're doing, let's talk about your album. But I suppose it was around the second album, Back to Black, which was an interesting album, also from a business sense. And it was one of those albums that they put out and it did all right. And then they kept pushing it. And then it started doing really well.
Yeah.
And then really well. Yeah. And then like 18 months later, it's like, wow, this is a really, really big, important album. And obviously that was a hugely acclaimed album, but that was also around about the time that the tabloid stories started to become big news.
Rehab was on that album, which I guess the tabloid stuff hadn't really kicked off at that point, but it's her responding to suggestions that she might not be in the greatest place at that time. And it certainly is quite a marker in her lifetime with hindsight.
And we talked earlier how we were possibly more sarcastic and harsh back in the day. I'm not sure we were ever harsh about Amy Winehouse, actually, because I mean, I only spoke to her on the phone for 20 minutes, but whenever she was on TV on good form, she was clearly such a nice person that was a delight to be around when she was on form. And so I don't think we were ever harsh about Amy Winehouse, but we did report a lot on all of that tabloidy stuff. And particularly there was that period where she kept missing shows or cancelling shows, or not giving particularly good shows, despite the fact that we all knew her capabilities when she really sort of came to the fore. And so we did report about that a lot. And I must admit, you sort of look back, because now with hindsight we know the incredibly tragic conclusion to that story, saying, well, should we have been making such light of it at the time? Very occasionally I fall into a YouTube hole where somebody post something about what Simon Amstel is up to these days.
Yeah.
And then through the sidebar, I end up seeing clips from his era hosting Nevermind the Buzzcocks.
Yeah.
And of course, some of the Pop World interviews that predate that. And obviously, that was very much the era when Amy Winehouse was on the rise. And there's a couple of Pop World pieces with Amy Winehouse where, again, she comes across as being this incredibly charismatic, funny, great person to be. But there is the obviously, when she was a guest on Amstel era Buzzcocks, and that very much is honing in on and making light of her widely documented drinking problem in the main. And at the time, that seemed really funny.
Mm.
And with hindsight, it seems deeply, deeply tragic. Because we all know the conclusion of this is that she died way, way, way too prematurely in 2011. And so the conclusion of all of that was having to write her obituary. And it was one of those things where, with hindsight, perhaps that tragic conclusion may have been foreseeable. But despite all of the reportage, both what we were writing and you know, obviously way, way more was being written by the tabloid newspapers in particular about Amy Winehouse's inner demons in those latter years, nevertheless, the day that that news came through, I remember being really shocked and that was the conclusion that we had reached.
Yeah, that was a very strange day. I went to a festival that day. It really changed my experience of that festival quite considerably. I got a text message from someone on my way to that event saying, have you heard Amy Winehouse has died? It's like, I now remember that event more for that than actually any of the music I saw that day.
But I think one reason why it's worth mentioning Amy Winehouse as part of our look back at the last 20 years of CMU is almost, I think, there were three ways in which we wrote a lot about her and her impact. So we did write a lot about the music. The reason I interviewed her was because we made Back to Black one of our albums of the year, because we used to have such a thing back then. It was in the era when we tried to interview everybody who had made one of our albums of the year. So I had 20 minutes on the phone with Amy Winehouse, during which she was taking a pizza order for seemingly about 20 other people in the room. So most of the interview was her doing a pizza order while I was desperately trying to ask her some questions. So we did write lots about her great music, but we did also write about the tabloid escapades. But also, I think in more recent years, one thing that's been very interesting to see in particularly the UK music industry and then the wider music industry to an extent is the much more frank conversation that we have been having about mental health and just physical health for artists and everybody working in the music industry. And obviously, you shouldn't put a line in the sand and say this was what changed the conversation, because there were a number of things that changed the conversation around mental health in the music community.
The film about Amy Winehouse was a particular catalyst for the development of that conversation.
Yeah, I think it's definitely fair for us to say that. There were some other things. Obviously, there were other articles and programs about mental health in general, putting particularly depression much more to the fore. But it does feel like once that movie was out there, which is a fascinating movie. I mean, it was made by her record company.
Yes.
So not necessarily an entirely unbiased interpretation.
The record company comes out of it pretty well.
Unsurprisingly. But nevertheless, I think it made a lot of people in the music industry sort of stand back and be like, yeah, as an industry, we can't necessarily pinpoint who, when and how, but as an industry, it was kind of with hindsight so obvious that we need to have a better way of dealing with this. And obviously what we've seen in more recent years is a very frank conversation about the mental health and physical health of artists and also everyone working in the music industry. And more importantly than that, tangible steps being taken by organisations like Help Musicians and Music Support and the Music Managers Forum to provide advice and guidance to where artists and people who work with artists can go when they are struggling with physical or mental health. Because there are some things about the music industry, and particularly for artists, particularly successful artists who suddenly have that period in their career where suddenly they can basically get whatever they like and fire whoever they like, particularly on the management agency side. They don't have the framework of being an employee of some organization. And it's a weird, weird situation to be in. And huge conversation in recent years about how the music industry can better support artists in that situation. And I would like to think it's slow steps, obviously, but I think, well, certainly the conversation is way better than it was 5 years ago.
Yes.
And I think we are also starting to see a few tangible steps that hopefully artists in the future who might have similar problems, obviously, you know, you can't predict anything that would happen, but at least would have a few more people coming forward offering some tangible, practical help.
Yes.
So I think a number of different ways in which Amy Winehouse has influenced the reporting in CMU over the years.
Now, you mentioned before our legal coverage and the fact that we like to report on ongoing cases in quite a lot of detail. And one story that was not fun, but stretched over a long period of time, including two trials, was the Phil Spector murder case.
Yes, we talked about how we cover in depth when artists and music makers end up in court, whether that's civil litigation or it's criminal action. We also talked about how we often put more sarcasm and humour into our artists' reporting. There was no sarcasm and no humour in this. It was a horrible, horrible story to cover. And to an extent, it's not even something we particularly want to talk about on a podcast, because it's not what this podcast is made for. But of course, Phil Spector, the legendary record producer, famously a recluse, so almost the opposite of those artists who are out there doing the party circuit and being papped and put on the tabloids. A quite reclusive character, but you know, a legendary producer behind some incredibly famous and very groundbreaking recordings. But of course, ended up in court over allegations that in 2003 he had caused the death, so basically murdered a woman who had come back to his home in California. The woman was called Lana Clarkson, and he was accused of having caused her death by shooting her. He claimed it was a suicide and that it was a self-inflicted wound. And it resulted in a very high profile, particularly the first trial, a very high profile, widely documented trial in which he insisted that he was innocent. Meanwhile, the prosecutors and the family of the victim of Lana Clarkson presented a whole load of evidence to back up their claims, including various allegations about previous incidents between Phil Spector and women that he had known and worked with or who he had invited back to his home. And obviously, ultimately, he was found guilty at the end of the second trial and has been in prison ever since. But it was a very gruesome story that we reported on, certainly the first trial, day by day, as they went through all of the different levels of evidence, slightly less so on the second trial because it went over most of the same ground, although that resulted in that final conviction. But yeah, a massive story in terms of a music maker being in court accused of a very serious crime, which was pretty much a daily appearance in the CMU Daily for months as that criminal case and trial went through the very slow motions.
Now, lastly, an artist whose career we pretty much covered from the start and who became very much a fixture of CMU, well, less so in recent years, but there was a period where he was very much a fixture of CMU's coverage, Justin Bieber.
And this is an artist whose various exploits have provided plenty of sarcasm and humour, although even he had a moment where it was like, hang on a second, we really shouldn't be mocking this guy anymore. But yeah, we've been covering Bieber's career since the very start. I remember the first time we covered him.
I mean, it started humorously.
It did start humorously. Was he been doing the shopping mall circuit in the
yes.
US? So this was before really he'd had any much coverage over here. And he'd been doing this.
Yes. No, well, I remember coming in and you saying, I've never heard of this artist, but I think we should cover him because if he can get 3,000 people to a shopping mall, then he's probably going to be famous, isn't he?
It really felt just through that one story that clearly there was something here that was gaining momentum and was probably going to go global, which of course it did. So yes, he'd done this gig in a shopping mall. And I suppose it was the early days of social media.
Well, he hadn't even played it. So many people turned up to it. They cancelled it. And then there was a whole thing where the police were trying to get someone from his record label to tweet that the show wasn't happening and everyone should go away, and they refused to do it. And then I think him and I believe Scoot Braun as well were both arrested for not tweeting, which turns out not a crime.
So yeah, it was a fun story in that we had this new emerging pop star who was bringing shopping malls to a close, and then there was a quirky Twitter angle to it, because again, early days of Twitter being such a big deal as well. And so that was the first time we covered Bieber. I think we sensed he was going to become a global phenomenon. I don't think we anticipated quite the soap opera that his life would become, feeding the and finally slot of CMU on many, many occasions, and occasionally the legal slot too.
Yes, very much so. I think my favourite Bieber period was the period when he kept walking into doors. That was a highlight.
Possibly exaggerated slightly, but there were two videos really close succession, weren't there? Where he walked into glass doors in a very comedic way. And it did become one of the... we've had various running gags in the CMU Daily over the years. I always wonder how many people notice the running gags, although a lot of people mention Frilled to me.
Yes.
So clearly I think enough of our readers have noticed that
and
running
people
gag.
Like the Bieber walking into doors, because we used to put that, I can't remember exactly what we did now, but for a long time I think we used to post that video claiming it was something else in a kind of Rick Rolling fashion.
Well, whenever there was a Bieber story, I think yes, the conclusion would always be, here's a film of Justin Bieber walking into a glass door. Then there was the year where he did become the front page tabloid news guy and the not showing up for shows guy and making his 8-year-old fans wait 90 minutes for his show so that it was past their bedtime before he came on stage era, which was the point at which it got to the stage where it's like, actually, maybe we shouldn't be mocking this guy anymore.
Take a darker turn.
But I suppose the good news there is he seemed to overcome that, came back with actually having been very much a teeny pop artist in the early days, has done some incredibly interesting collaborations over the years, and came back with an album where people were like, oh, actually, we can now write about Justin Bieber's music. We don't have to write about all the nonsense. So has sort of overcome all of that, although does still generously provide us from time to time with a nonsense quote in an interview or on social media that we can stick in the and finally slot at times. Post all of that, you declared him the second coming of Jesus Christ himself, I seem to remember.
Well, that was when he pretty much declared himself that, I think. It was a bit, when he returned from that dark period, which I mean, acknowledged, like he's done an interview recently where he talked about how bad things went that time, and Scooter Braun's talked about how he was scared that something terrible was going to happen. But then he got through that, and he came back, but he sort of, yeah, started presenting himself as the world's nicest guy, which then we went overboard with, to the point that it was difficult to write about him because you couldn't go any more overboard with saying how nice Justin Bieber was now.
On what a nice guy he was. Although occasionally during that period, little bits of litigation would still come out of the woodwork, or little outstanding bits of criminal problems relating to that actually relatively small period of time when he was getting in trouble with his fans and his business partners and occasionally the law. But good on him for having a happy ending, I guess. And maybe we'll have more Bieber nonsense quotes to share, not necessarily at the moment, but in the future when he's next got an album to promote.
Well, that's all we've got time for on the latest of our 20th anniversary of CMU episodes.
If anybody has been looking at the list of the 20 stories that we picked out last May, the 20 biggest stories in CMU's first 20 years in business, you may have noticed we've ticked off three in this special edition by talking about Amy Winehouse, Phil Spector and Justin Bieber. So that's efficient of us.
It is. I think we're up to 15 now, so five more to go.
That's according to Andy Malt's maths, which may or may not be correct.
It is definitely correct.
Okay, well, five more of these to come.
Yes, and you can listen to all the ones we've already done by going to setlistpodcast.com. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty, edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.